Well, we're continuing our study in the book of Galatians, and last time, actually 2 weeks ago, because we had our meeting last Wednesday, we began studying chapter 5, and the beginning of chapter 5 is what we've been referring to, or I've been referring to, as the beginning of the practical section of the book of Galatians. Chapter 1 and 2 is the personal section where Paul talks about himself quite a bit, because he's defending his apostleship. He's defending the message that he preached to the Galatians, and he spends really chapter 1 and 2 explaining to them that he is an apostle, that he was sent from Jesus Christ, and that his message did come from God. And that's really, if you read 1 and 2, you know, for the most part, it's all encapsulated in those two chapters, that personal section. Chapter 3 and 4, Paul reasoned from the Old Testament scriptures that the law no longer had power over men and women. And that we are no longer under its curse, but that it had been done away with. And that this was God's intention from the beginning. That was God's intention back when he made the promise to Abraham, that the law was not going to set aside that promise that he made to Abraham. That promise was going to remain. And the law was going to pass away. And that's exactly what Paul said happened. We're no longer under bondage to the law, but we now come to God through faith in Jesus Christ and become his children through faith. And that's chapters 3 and 4. He says a lot more in chapter 3 and 4, but it's related to that topic, and it's what we've been calling the doctrinal section of the book. And I think those are accurate divisions. I didn't make those up, but when you read the book of Galatians, you see 1 and 2 is personal, 3 and 4 is doctrinal. And then in this section, chapters 5 and 6, it brings us to the practical portion of the book. And he kind of brings everything he's discussed together here and says, now that we have this information, how should we conduct ourselves as Christians? Where does the rubber meet the road? What does this mean to us as we try to serve God? How should we conduct ourselves? And I think there's an interesting shift that happens here in chapter 5. Up through chapter 4, Paul has been rebuking these Christians for desiring to go back to the law, for thinking that somehow they can put themselves in a right relationship with God by observing the law. He's been rebuking them for that. And, that by doing good works, they could somehow tilt the scales in their favor in terms of their relationship with God. And his argument throughout, I'm reading the wrong section there. No, his argument throughout chapters 3 and 4 is that we just can't do that. We can't do enough good works to put ourselves in a right relationship with God. Why not? Unperfectness, which is what separates us from God? Sin. Yeah, good works cannot put aside sin. That's the problem. We can't do enough good works to put our sin aside. You know, we cannot tilt the scales that way. There's a block sitting there called sin. And we can't do anything about that sin, no matter how hard we try. In Luke chapter 17, what did Jesus say to the apostles there? When you have done everything that's commanded you to do, what must you say? We are unprofitable servants. We have done only that which is our duty to do. Even when we've done everything we're commanded, we're still unprofitable because we have sinned and separated ourselves from God. But the shift is, here, that happens in chapter 5 is, one might have the tendency to conclude that after everything Paul has said in chapter 4, how we're not under the burden of the law anymore, how we're not saved by works, how we can't justify ourselves, one might have the tendency to conclude that, well, I'm home free. I don't have to do anything now. I'm saved, my golden ticket is punched, and I can just coast into heaven. I think that may be a mixed metaphor, but I'm there. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But that's not the tone that Paul adapts in chapter 5 at all. And I want us to notice that as we read the first six verses again, and then what we get into in the beginning in verse 7. We studied 1 through 6 in depth last time, but let's go ahead and read those verses and get that passage before us, and then we'll go on through and look at 7 through 12. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm. Even right there, you've got something to do here. Keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You have been severed from Christ, you who are seeking to be justified by law, you have fallen from grace. For we, through the Spirit, by faith, are waiting for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love. And we had a lot to say about those verses, and I don't want to go over those again this evening, just for the sake of time. But let's continue reading this next section here. You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. I have confidence in you in the Lord that you will adopt no other view, but the one who is disturbing you shall bear his judgment, whoever he is. But I, brethren, if I still preach circumcision, why am I still persecuted? Then the stumbling of the cross has been abolished. Would that those who are troubling you would even mutilate themselves. Now let's stop there at verse 12 and continue on. Notice what he says here in this first verse. You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? Who's Paul talking to here, first of all? He's talking to Christians. Now, Christians who have gone into some error, but he says you were running well. You were on the right track. You were heading in the right direction. You were doing what you were supposed to do. And what happened? And what a powerful and revealing question I think he asked here. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? Does this sound to you like Paul is suggesting that those who are saved by faith can now just coast into heaven, as we discussed, that because we are not saved by works, we don't have to do anything now? Is that what it sounds like? What does this passage reveal about truth? Yeah, there's something to be done there, Ron. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people think of truth, well, it's just something to be believed, to be affirmed. But there's something more to it than that. And as you said, there's some structure. There's some response that has to happen when you are confronted with truth. And I think that's the point that's being made here. Did someone else want to say something? But truth is something we must obey. Look at Hebrews 5, 8, and 9, a passage that I love because it's just so revealing about our relationship with Christ. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered, and having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. No, biblical obedience is not an attempt to earn one's salvation. That's what we have to understand. That's not what we obey for. It's the submissive response of humble and contrite hearts in reverence for what God has instructed us to do. And according to this passage in Hebrews, as well as many others we could read, it's essential for our salvation, isn't it? What if you don't obey the truth? According to this passage, can you trust? Can you have faith that you have salvation? I think we'd have to say no.
In Thessalonians, he says that judgment comes upon all those who know not God and obey not the gospel of Christ.
Yeah, and we talked early on in Galatians about that a lot of folks in the religious world approached the book of Galatians saying that gospel is just the message of acceptance of salvation, that's all there is to it, that you believe as as Brother Tim said the other night, that you ask Jesus into your heart, and that's the gospel. That's not the definition of the gospel we see in the scriptures, is it? The gospel is something that's to be obeyed. It's something to be believed. It's something that we respond to. It's something that you can, you know, and truth here, you know, that we can wander away from. And who hindered these Galatians from obeying the truth here? But, you know, one question that comes, you know, if we're not obedient to God, to what he has revealed to us, what does that say about our faith? It says we don't have any. That's the kind of faith that saves us. It's a faith that trusts in God, that trusts in his words, that reveres him, and that responds to him. That's what faith is. If we aren't doing those things, then that's saying we don't have the faith we need to have. That, you know, and I think there is just so much confusion in the denominational world about what real faith is, Les. I think that's exactly right, and I really think we get into some even in this passage, or the next one especially, that really speaks to that very thing. Well, let's go ahead and move on to the next verse here. I mean, we can talk about Matthew 7:21 too, when it, you know, we talk about obeying the truth. You know, not everyone who says unto me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but who? He who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many are going to say unto me in that day, didn't we do this, Lord? Didn't we do this? Didn't? And what's he going to say? Depart from me, I never knew you. You who work lawlessness, without authority, iniquity, those things. That they have no basis for what they're doing. It's not obedience. It's what they think is right. Daryl. Yeah, and we read a passage in 1 John, I think it was 1 John last week, that perfect love cast out fear. See, when we love God and we submit to him in the way we should, then we shouldn't be fearing condemnation from him, because we know he wants what's in our best interest. So our motivation is not because of a fear of going to hell, or a fear of violating the command. Our motivation is because we love God and we have faith in him, and we believe that he cares for us in that way. And I think, but we cannot be saved without the proper attitude. But that's what I think faith is. I mean, look throughout the entire Bible, and that's what we see. Faith is shown by its actions. And you can start with, you know, Abraham, and through the rest, even Abel, you know, and through the rest of the scripture, and see that. It says, this persuasion did not come from him who calls you. And I've got a question, and I know a lot of times I don't even refer to the lesson sheets that I print up, but those basically give you something to think about and study in preparation for class. And as Joe Greer says, you know, those are the things I kind of to try to hit on as we study. But considering the preceding and following context, what is the persuasion Paul seems to be referencing here? that this persuasion did not come from him who calls you. Ron?
The one that's moving them from the truth. Yeah. Whatever is moving them from the truth is not from Christ.
I think that...
He's going to refer to that later.
Yeah, and I think... I kind of think it goes directly back to what he said back in 5, 2, and 3. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, and we got to understand this is circumcision as a means of justifying ourselves. You know, Paul circumcised Timothy. You know, that he's not, Timothy wasn't him, but if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision as a means of justification, I think we have to understand in this context, that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. And I think what Paul's saying, this did not come from God. It's what calls it. This persuasion did not come from he who calls you. Joe. Good to see you tonight, by the way, Joe.
not having been in the class, you know, previously and gone.
I've said so much, Joe, it's probably most forgotten anyway.
it strikes me just to take the point that you're making now and connect it to what you're saying about obedience to the truth a few moments ago. The ironic thing is that these people who were persuading them to go in a different direction from the gospel, are not telling them to do nothing. They're telling them to do the wrong thing. And that is the key difference between obedience of faith and the justification by works, is a person is trying to justify himself by what he chooses to do. That's one of the main differences. Rather than simply submitting to God through the Spirit.
It's
not a difference between doing something and not doing something. It's a difference
It reminds me of what Paul said in Romans 10 about his brethren, the Jews, that he would wish he would be a curse for their sake, because they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. They're seeking to establish what? A righteousness of their own. And I think we see that all the time in the religious world today. People are seeking to establish a righteousness of their own. Yes, sir.
I'm like him. I have been here and I haven't studied this carefully, but just looking at a couple of things. One, it almost seems like there's a play on words, because those two words, obey and persuasion, are actually the same Greek word. They're the same.
I did not realize that, but that's a good point.
And the most common definition of the word in verse 7 is to be persuaded. And it seems that the persuasion that didn't come from him who called you is the persuasion to not accept the truth of this message, that you've got to turn away from the old law. You've got to rely on Jesus and on your faith in Jesus. That's the thing that they have been convinced not to accept, not to trust in.
Exactly.
So those, and again, not only have I not been in class, I'm not a Greek scholar, but I can read the dictionary.
You've got one step on me right there. That makes sense. I had not realized that those words were related, Joe.
Just along those lines, I think it's a very significant point. The root concept in faith, belief, persuasion, and obedience in their background all come back to the same place. The pistis, those kinds of words all get back to the idea of persuasion and their root concept. It's the basic idea.
Very good comments. I appreciate that. Where was I now? Let's look at this next verse here. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. What is the point he's making here? It seems like this just comes out of nowhere in the, you know, reading in this passage. But what is Paul saying here? A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. And a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. What is he saying? Yes, James?
That it's like an old high school game, middle school game you used to play, where your teacher would set you in a row of chairs, and you'd whisper, she'd whisper something in your ear, and as it goes along, the sentence tends to change. Just takes just a little bit of walking away from something to get you to continue that journey away from the truth.
You know, that Paul says an interesting thing in chapter 1. He says, I'm amazed that you are so soon removed from the gospel for another gospel, which is really not another gospel. I'm paraphrasing a little bit there. But in the slightest bit that the gospel is changed or diluted, it is no longer the gospel, I think, is the point he's making there. That when you change it, it does not remain the gospel any longer. It is no longer the power of God unto salvation. And that's what he's trying to tell them. Yes, Rachel. Fulfillment of just like the Jews in Romans 10. Yeah, good point. Les.
That phrase there, they have something to do with the fact that he's already, or will, or already has mentioned that if you accept or put your trust in circumcision, then you're a debtor to do the whole law. And so it's kind of like a little, if you accept a little bit of this law keeping as though you're obligating God for then you're going to have to do all that.
Yeah, and you know, and it honestly, I was not. I know people say, "What are you going to say? Something dishonest?" But I was not thinking in that direction. But I think that makes more sense in this passage. I was thinking, you know, look at what happened to Peter over in chapter 2. Those Judaizing teachers came down from Jerusalem, and what happened with Peter? He kind of went away with them a little bit, and removed himself from the Gentiles. And who followed him? All the other Jewish Christians, and even Barnabas. Barnabas, the son of encouragement, was carried away by his hypocrisy. So I could see it working both ways. But I think that's an excellent point that's being made here, is that he may just be talking about the once the truth is compromised, it's compromised. It compromises the entire lump. I think that might even make more sense in the context. Saw another. Ron?
Yes, usually in the New Testament, the leavening has always been more of an evil aspect than good. But we know that.
And the kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman put in some measures of meal. I can't remember how many, but anyway.
The whole effort of the scriptures has been to initially keep a particular figure the same way, though there are times when it has been used for good. But here it just shows us that this can be evil if we allow this to go on. Obviously, the context is circumcision.
Yeah.
There's no question of context from the beginning of the chapter here. It's all about circumcision coming into the body, and Paul is saying, we're keeping this out.
Yeah.
This is not allowed to come in. You cannot make this a part of the gospel of Christ. Yeah. And of course, Acts 15. So there's no, there's, he again is making this point that we're not going to allow Judaizing teachers, those who are going to bring the law in, particularly circumcision, not going to come in.
Yeah, and
we'll let the whole law. At that point, then it's keeping all the law of Moses. What do you leave out at that point? Allow circumcision in, then all of it becomes.
And that's what he said. If you're going to keep one thing, you got to keep it all. And I've kind of wondered if circumcision is what you would call a metonymy, that it just kind of representative of the entire law. Yeah, exactly.
Seems
but
to be the issue, though, at that point.
Oh, yeah, and that was definitely the issue in the forefront where everything came from, you know, especially with the Jews coming down from Jerusalem to Antioch. Let's go ahead and move on to the next statement here. I have confidence in you and the Lord that you will adopt no other view, but the one who is disturbing you shall bear his judgment, whoever he is. And you know, Paul's trying to be encouraging to these brethren as well. And I think it's interesting. I had a couple things I wanted to say here. Let me say what I have to say in order, or else I'll get confused, and you'll be confused, and it'll be a big mess. But anyway, what is Paul's confidence regarding those in the Lord here? What won't they do? According to the text here, I have confidence in you in the Lord that that you will adopt no other view. And I think the view in question here is really what he says here in, I think, in Galatians 5, 5, and 6, if you want to look at it. For we, through the Spirit, by faith, are waiting for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love. And that's really what he's saying the gospel is. It's not whether you're circumcised. It's not what any, and you can, we talked last week, you can take pride in the fact that you're not circumcised. Hey, I'm saved because I wasn't circumcised. That's not the attitude either. It's that our righteousness is through Christ, our hope of righteousness is what he calls it here, is in Christ Jesus. And it's faith working through love that accomplishes that. And that's the faith that serves God the way it should be. Let me go on here before we answer some other questions. And what does Paul say regarding the one who is disturbing the Galatian Christians here? Let me get rid of that. That he will bear his judgment, whoever he is. I think it's interesting that he uses the singular here. Now, I don't know if he had one individual in mind. Now, this is a number of churches. Or if he's just trying to get them to take it personally, you know, this person is going to bear, he is going to bear his judgment. But, you know, Paul makes a distinction between two groups here. Those who are, I think what he's saying is you and the Lord, you whose motives are to serve the Lord in faith from pure hearts. I have confidence that you're going to come through this and you're going to hold to the truth. But the person who is doing this, whoever he is going to bear his judgment. And I think it all goes to motives. I don't know if this is the passage Ron referred to, but you know, there were Christians there, I'm sure, whose desire was to serve God as perfectly as they could, from pure hearts, from pure motives, and to serve him in truth. And there were others, we know, whose motives were not so pure. And I think those are the ones Paul's saying who are going to bear the judgment. But it made me think of what we're told over in 2 Thessalonians 2:10 about those who did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. And that's the demarcation point, isn't it? In this case, it would seem to me that there's those who love truth, who want to do what's right, and want to serve God and please him, and that there's those whose motives are not pure. It makes me think of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the pure in heart for what? For they shall see God. And I've said before, probably 37 times, that I think that the point there is that those with pure hearts are those whose hearts are free from agenda, who just want to do what's right. They're going to see God for who he is and see his word for what it really says. But those who want to establish a righteousness of their own to do what they want to do, I remember when I first became a Christian. Most of you know I play guitar and I love music. I wanted to use my guitar in worship to the Lord. I was all ready to go. I mean, I'm telling you, that was my thinking. And a brother set me down and said, listen, you know, here's some reasons why, you know, you may want to consider that this isn't the thing to do. And as much as I want, and I'm not trying to build myself up here, but I said, you know, I see that. That makes sense. You know, that we don't see any examples of Christians using instrumental music in worship. How many times has that been a sticking point with people we've studied with, though? That they, instrumental music in worship is that something they love and they want to do, and they will not let go of it because it's something they want to do. And it seems to me that those are people maybe that have not received the love of the truth. That they just want to do what they want to do no matter what. And they're going to go someplace that practices it. And there's plenty of choices out there. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's perhaps what's, you know, what happens sometimes. I saw a hand. Rachel? For influence sake,
but there were others who were finding their agenda, and he would not put up with that. And it's like us, I think he's saying here through this context, and later he talks about this, which they mutilate themselves. He's saying, you're so interested in cutting off the foreskin, what you're doing is cutting off Christ. You're not, he's not.
Well, he talks about being severed from Christ. I think that's a play on words. With circumcision, when you go back and think about that, I think that's what he's saying. Yeah, good point. Let's go ahead and move on here. Oh, I wanted to Galatians 4:7. Oh, here's some. He's talking about those who will bear the judgment. I mean, their motives were not pure. Here's what he says about them in Galatians 4:17. They eagerly seek you, not commendably, but they wish to shut you out, I think, saying, you're not saved. You need to be circumcised in order that you'll, hey, what do I need to do? You're the teacher. I need to, you know, I think that's what they were doing. They were looking for that preeminence, you know, and wanting to be the you know, the leaders and the people with the knowledge and the authority. That, but their motives were not accurate. Let's go on to the next section here, verse 11. But I, brethren, if I still preach circumcision, why am I still persecuted? Then the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished. And there seems to be a strong indication here that the some of the Jews were saying, these Judaizers, well, Paul preaches circumcision. You know, why might they say that? Exactly. And he had Timothy circumcised there in Jerusalem during the council at Jerusalem. At that point, he had Timothy circumcised. And I think it was for the sake of influence. He didn't want anything to get in the way of that. Was that, am I right? That's where he had... No, he didn't have Titus circumcised there. He had Timothy circumcised. I knew that. I was just seeing if you all were paying attention. You did good, Joe. You passed.
Yeah. He did that so that...
Yeah, it would not be a stumbling block for them. Exactly. I got it a little backwards. No, I think you're exactly right, yeah. That's a whole other topic and a whole other book.
So you're demanding something like that. Well,
yeah.
You don't put up with that. It's like people today, even in the church, who will bind the traditions of the fathers as if that was law. And it's not. It's just their preference. You can have a preference, but you
think that's exactly right. What was Paul citing here as proof that he wasn't preaching circumcision? Yeah, why am I being persecuted? These Jews would not be persecuting me if I was preaching circumcision. And I mean, it's basically the same thing he said back here in the allegory of Sarah and Hagar. But at that time, he who was born according to the flesh, which was Ishmael, persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit. So it is now also. And Paul's being persecuted by these Judaizing teachers because he is not preaching circumcision. That's why they're persecuting him. I've got a quote here from the Garvey and Pendleton I thought was very well worded. This is related to the stumbling block. We'll go ahead and read it real quick. This precious value then is for you who believe, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, for they stumbled because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were appointed. But when he's talking about that Jesus Christ has become a stumbling block. The gospel has become a stumbling block. And it's become a stumbling block to those who are disobedient to the word, who don't understand the message. But here's what McGarvey and Pendleton said. Paul taught that the whole Jewish system of ordinances perished at the cross, and that on the cross Jesus made the one and only atonement for sin. Such teaching was a stumbling block to the Jews. Had Paul rejected the doctrine of the cross and preached circumcision, as these Judaizers contended that he did, would they wish to countenance their errors with his authority, he would have been a hero among the Jews. And there's, you know, they're accusing him of preaching circumcision, but they're still persecuting him, so they're just using him, basically, saying, oh, well, Paul did this, so Paul preaches that. They're trying to, you know, go back behind and say, oh, well, this is what he did here. And we see that those sort of tactics all the time. Let's go ahead. It looks like we're going to get through this section tonight, and that's about it, but that's okay. We've had some good discussion. It says, would that those who are troubling you would even mutilate themselves. What do you think Paul's saying here?
This is such a bad problem that it really truly needs to be severed off, cut off, and removed. I wish they would. I mean, obviously, he's unable to remove that.
Yeah,
and they're going to continue to be a thorn in his flesh throughout his whole ministry, even until he ends up in Rome. And even in Rome, he struggles with the same difficulties. Fortunately, he didn't have a fresh path there. With the Judaizing teachers, hadn't got there yet, but they've been hearing a lot. And so when he did have at least an open door for a while with them. But yeah, all the way through his ministry until he ended up in Rome, he couldn't get rid of them.
Yeah, and
they could just be removed.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's one interpretation. A lot of commentators, the literal Greek here is cut themselves off. And I some believe that he means make themselves eunuchs, go one step beyond circumcision. And one commentator said, you know, Paul, an apostle, would never say anything like that. He would, you know, that an apostle would not do that. I disagree. I think that goes to the severity of what they have done. What they have done is they have diminished the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross by saying, that's not enough. What Jesus did on the cross for us is not enough. You have to do this. You have to go back to the law. You have to be circumcised. You have to keep all these ordinances and the feast and all these other things. And it diminishes what Jesus did. And I don't have a problem with Paul saying what he says here, if that's what he's saying, which some think, a lot seem to think. So, but you know, go ahead.
Actually, Paul's on mutilation.
Yeah. Yeah, the New American Standard says mutilate. Yeah. Yeah, for
so he actually gives them the literal autonomy, as you call it.
Earlier. Yeah, yeah.
He places that upon them that they are really mutilating the gospel.
There is really a strong play on words there in so many ways, and it's just. I mean, these are very, very powerful words. He's being encouraging to those who are in the Lord, and saying, I really believe that you're going to do better than that. You're going to come through this. But to those who are continuing in this false teaching, he's saying you need to be cut off. You need to be taken care of. Joe.
From the beginning of the letter, he has utilized strong language to respond to the seriousness of what they're doing. Those who do this, let them be anathema.
Yeah. You know, and there's such an ironic thing here. So many people take this book and they say, well, you know, it just means we're saved by faith and we don't have to do anything. I quoted, can't remember his name all of a sudden, Scottish guy, who says what the message of Galatians is: faith plus nothing. And I really like the teacher. He's a denomination, but has a lot of very good lessons. And I can't remember his name all of a sudden. No, it's what is it, Les? Alistair Begg. Yeah, I like Alistair Begg. I like a lot of his teaching, but I disagree with that statement so much. And the whole book talks about that there are so many things you have to do in response to the gospel. And you have to accept certain, you can't just believe anything you want to believe. If you do, then you're anathema if you accept this, if you teach this. I mean, it's just so ironic that people say, well, you don't have to do anything, and the whole book is about, and wait till we get later in the chapter. Those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Doesn't sound like it. Yeah, that's a dead faith. Yeah. Thank you all for your kind attention and your very good comments this evening.